From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Governor Andrew Cuomo rolled out his state budget plan this week, and in that plan, he solved a kind of mystery that's been bouncing around Albany for weeks. You see, New York State has a windfall of more than $5 billion in bank settlements, and everyone's been wondering, how would the governor propose to spend that money? Turns out he wants to spend it in a combination of infrastructure repairs and improvements, education, and an upstate economic competition. But hold on a moment. What if New York State's fiscal house isn't nearly in the rosy shape we've been presented? What if there's hidden debt that we don't often talk about? My colleague Matthew Leonard from the Innovation Trail is here. And Matthew, always great to work with you.
Yep, great to be back. Thanks, Evan. It's been a very interesting week.
And
the kind of analysis that we probably would have done around the state budget, you know, maybe yesterday,
right,
sort of got run over by a news truck of fairly big proportions. So we're going to sort of, you know, take stock, slow down a little bit, and circle back on the business of the state and the budget, which came out an immense, as our colleague Karen DeWitt said, an immense tome of like 548 pages was dropped on the internet on Wednesday afternoon after the governor's joint State of the State and budget presentation. Listeners out there, if you are near the internet and you want to have a look, we've uploaded the 2015-16 New York State Budget Briefing Book in digital form on both WXXI News and innovationtrail.org. You can go there. It's a PDF, but you can sort of scroll through it and look at the different sort of areas of the budget. And to help us kind of navigate this, I'm very happy to say we're joined by Sheila Weinberg. Sheila is the founder and CEO of the nonpartisan institute Truth in Accounting, which is based in Illinois. Welcome, Sheila. Thanks very much for being with us on Innovation Friday.
Well, thanks for having me.
And so tell us a little bit about the sort of the mission of the institute, and then we can sort of help folks kind of track a pathway through this, understanding what state budgets are and looking at the state of real debt in New York.
Well, Truth in Accounting is working to educate citizens about the accurate financial information of their governments, because we feel for so long citizens have really not had the financial information they need to be knowledgeable participants in their governments.
No, wait, you mean governments aren't giving us accurate information? I'm completely shocked that you'd say that.
I know, it's shocking.
So,
And I honestly don't understand why people, laugh about it. It's like, is that not something we should expect from our elected officials and government officials?
Right. So now, is it that they're so how much of this is the way in which that information is presented and people's ability to really interpret and comprehend that information? And how much of it, I guess, do you think is sort of a deliberately an outcome of the nature of politics itself?
Well, I think a lot of it is the nature of politics. The states and local governments, just along with the federal governments, just do not include on their balance sheets liabilities that corporations are required to use. They use a totally different accounting system than corporations are required to use, and the result is all these horrible financial conditions that states are in.
Right. Tell us a little bit about what's different about the modeling that Truth in Accounting uses. What sort of methodology you used when you're looking at the books of say New York State?
Well, what we use is we do go ahead and take the audited financial statements of the state, and then we add on there the off balance sheet. Remember, Enron, they had billions of dollars of off balance sheet items. Well, all the governments have off balance sheet pension and retiree health care liabilities that we add to the financial statement numbers.
Let me just jump in and say for our listeners, as we have this conversation about the way your governments are transparent or not when it comes to debt, spending, etc., if you want to join the conversation on Innovation Friday, you can. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I was going to ask Sheila if there are common accounting tricks that governments use to hide real numbers, and I guess that off-balance sheet one is maybe top of the list?
That is on the top of the list. The other ones they might do is, you know, again, focusing on Enron type of accounting, they often record loan proceeds as revenues. And then they just do not include all of their expenses in their books. They, you know, so they only include, you know, the checks that they write. So if they want to balance their budget, they just, you know, say, well, we're just not going to write the checks for the expenses that we've incurred.
So what sort of a picture then have you kind of developed about New York State's financial situation? And I'm not sure whether that's changed or whether you've had a chance to really sort of reassess that in light of, you know, the most recent executive budget that was brought down. But give us a kind of broad outline of where you see these, where these debts are kind of lying within the overall picture.
Well, first, I would highly recommend to your readers to not read the 518-page budget.
Okay, that's good to know.
We do not analyze those because they are just political mumbo-jumbo. And, you know, they'll have general fund money over there, and then they'll shift that over here. And it's pretty much just a political document. What we go on, and we recommend that your listeners go on and use, is the audited financial statement. So our numbers are as of the last audited financial statements of the state, which was March 31st, 2014. If your readers want to find that report and also the state's audited financial report and our report, they can go to our sister website called statedatalab.org. And click on New York, and it will give you the real financial information about New York.
Which is what, $78 billion in hidden debt? Is that the number I saw?
Yes, $78 billion in hidden debt.
Now, just also looking, and I would definitely recommend that site to listeners and people on the web as well, statedatalab.org, because you can sort of build up your own, you can put in your own data points. That's what I really like about it, that you can sort of add particular components to the overall picture. Just to ask you about the role of the audited financial reports, I'm also looking at the Office of the State Controller for the State of New York, in this case, mm-hmm. Tom DiNapoli. So that's where those audited financial statements are generated, is that right?
Right, and then they have an outside CPA firm, you know, audit them.
Right.
So again, you know, they can't play the what I call political math that, you know, they do. The only political, you know, large political math they do there is they don't include $78 billion of retiree health care benefits. But, you know, we, you know, diligently dug through the financial report and the actuarial report, and we, you know, found the actual, you know, true liabilities, retirement liabilities.
Can I also ask, because if our listeners go to the website for Truth in Accounting, the first thing you see is the U.S. published national debt of $18 yes. trillion dollars, and a line that says the truth, $83 trillion. Your share, $261,000. It indicates to me, well, actually it leads me to have a question. Is there anybody, whether it's a state government or other form of government, Sheila, who is publishing the numbers that your organization perceives as accurate and real?
No. Under the current accounting standards, the governments are in essence required not to report the accurate numbers. We did get the accounting standards changed, so next year the governments will have to start reporting, the state and local governments will have to start reporting their pension liability on the face of their balance sheet.
Well, it was not so long ago that the vice president of this country at the time, Dick Cheney, famously said, well, deficits don't matter. And if what you're saying, Sheila, is that states and the U.S. federal government are operating with hidden debt or costs that are not being accurately built into budgets, that we're running all of these deficits and we're accruing all this debt, but it was Dick Cheney who said deficits don't matter. Why do we need to be more concerned about this?
Well, the same reason that you have, you know, theoretical balanced budget requirements. The intent of that was so the citizens could hold their elected officials accountable. And the way you hold them accountable is you charge them for the services and benefits that the government's getting. So So if I offer a program, you know, obviously you're always going to have a constituency that wants to expand government. The offset is people have to pay for it. But if you can hide the cost, then you don't have to pay for those hidden costs, and therefore the taxpayers do not really know how much their governments cost, and they can't hold their elected officials accountable.
Right. So just to talk a little bit about the issue of assets, and one thing that you identify in terms of the way in which New York State assets are calculated is that a lot of those things are capital assets, things we might call it, part of that might be infrastructure as well, roads, buildings, and so on. These are assets that are put into the mixes as being kind of liquid, but in fact you make the point that the substantial proportion of those capital assets, you know, they can't be liquidated to pay bills, pay debt.
Right, and, you know, they could do like our famous Chicago where they, you know, sold, you know, one of their bridges. But, you know, in financial management, it is highly suggested that, you know, businesses do not sell capital assets to pay for current bills. Those should be excluded from paying your current expenses because they're a long-term asset. Also on the asset side, I noticed that in the governor's budget, the little bit I read, because I didn't want to get confused, I noticed he used a term that, and I think you guys talked about in the introduction, that there's reserves.
Right. Now, I was going to ask you about this idea, and there's been a lot of discussion around windfall, reserve, that kind of stuff. Tell us what your thoughts are.
Well, reserves in government speak just mean that you have money in your checkbook. That's all it means. It ignores how much bills you have or how much you owe to the pensions. So, you know, it's kind of like you going around and touting that, hey, I have $10,000 in my checkbook without mentioning that you're deep in debt, in credit card debt.
Right. So you're concealing this whole other layer of liability and risk that the state is in, but you're saying, oh, look at our top level, we're looking great and we're going to be able to spend. Now, is there a way that you can buy, I mean, let me ask you this, is there a way that you can invest, even with carrying that debt, is there a way that if you do have that sort of, let's say it's a windfall or a one-off windfall that you can then invest in infrastructure, is that a way to sort of buy your way out or to get into a better position to be able to deal with debt?
If you buy into infrastructure that is going to help future taxpayers or is going to generate revenue for the state, you know, the other thing that you could do with that, quote, reserves or the windfalls are, you know, we calculate that you have, in essence, $131 billion of bills that you have no idea where you're going to get the money to pay for those. You know, maybe you should consider using this, quote, windfall to pay for some of those. Maybe put money into your pension fund, or your retiree health care benefits are $92 billion underfunded. They have no money set aside to fund those. Maybe you should consider doing that with that money.
Right. And I'm sure that's definitely been, I think that's something that even, that I could be wrong, but I think the state controller's actually made some comments along those lines. So that, what does that kind of, is that something that taxpayers or people are going to feel at any sort of day-to-day level or any sort of year-to-year level going forward, this approach to debt? And
well, what they're going to do is in the future, they're going to pay taxes, and some of those taxes are going to pay for bill services and benefits that prior taxpayers got. So I'm going to pay taxes, and I'm not going to get any benefit from those taxes.
And the implication is that's already going on right now, Sheila.
Yes, that's okay. Already going on right now.
And here's a question from one of our listeners. Jake writes to the program, "It's not really surprising to hear this. I'm generally number savvy, and this kind of accounting terrifies me. What is being done to educate the general public without their eyes rolling into the back of their heads?"
Well, you guys mentioned what you found on our truthinaccounting.org website and our State Data Lab website. We produce a 2-page document that highlights the financial condition of every single state, including New York. What is not being done, and the offset of that, is this discussion of reserves and windfalls. So if you went to the, you know, to to your taxpayers and citizens and said, hey, well, you know, we need to, say, fund our retiree health care benefits, they'd be like, well, what's the problem? We have extra money laying around.
And so in that fact sheet you mentioned, Sheila, you're talking about each taxpayer's share of the New York State debt is $20,000, $20,800. And so is the scenario then that if this is unchecked, I mean, clearly that number is going to be ticking upwards going forward if the same approach is, it continues to be adopted, right?
Yes, and, you know, that amount represents the amount that each taxpayer would have to send to the state capital, the state treasury, right now, just to catch up on prior bills that have been accumulated.
Right. So now let's just talk a little bit, go into the pension issue a little bit more, because this is something we've seen within other fiscally stressed cities and states. For example, I mean, Detroit famously had issues that achieved a lot of coverage because there was the city went bankrupt and had to sort of come up with strategies to emerge from that. Why hasn't New York State kind of gone the same way? If what you're saying is true, that there's this level of debt, how does it manage to kind of continue to, you know, remain solvent or sort of struggle on it, and clearly then offer, as the governor has done in this latest budget, continue to put up spending plans?
Because they just haven't run out of that cash. You know, they have enough tax dollars to cover the current cost, and also they, you know, continue not to fund the retiree health care benefits. So people have to look at employee compensation doesn't just include their paychecks. It includes these pension and retiree health care benefits that you earn the right to receive every year. But the state is not putting money aside to fund those. They're using that money for other purposes.
Just wonder whether you... So a lot of this money that the Governor Cuomo talked about on Wednesday is a result of these large payouts from financial institutions in the state. So is that why the net revenue... I'm just looking at your state data lab chart for net revenue. Is that something that clearly skews the net revenue trajectory because of this sort of one-off payment? But that's all sort of happening on the surface and has no real effect on the underlying picture of debt that you're telling us about.
Yes, that would be if it was received in 2014, the fiscal year ended March 31st, 2014, then it would be in that revenue number.
Right, right.
But then the other side would be, you know, to add insult to injury, is the proper funding of the pensions and retiree health care liabilities.
Right.
Talking for a few more minutes with Sheila Weinberg, the founder and CEO of Truth in Accounting. They're online at what's the website, Matthew Leonard?
Yeah, truthinaccounting.org. Okay. And statedatalab.org.
Okay, and so a couple quick comments from listeners as well, Sheila. Jake follows up to say, I hope you give out the address for their report again. How many years have they been providing this data?
We have been doing this since 2009. We've calculated the financial condition of every single state. Again, you can go to New York's from statedatalab.org. You can click on New York and get the current years. And also on our website, you can either truthinaccounting.org or the statedatalab.org. You can get the comprehensive report that includes every single state's information since 2009.
And Mark writes to the program, so what should New York State do then? Austerity / spending? We're not going to make up $78 billion, right? Should we raise taxes?
Well, what I say is, you know, he's finally asking questions about, you know, maybe how you should dig out of the financial crisis that you're in. But the other citizens are not asking that question because, again, they're told everything is fine, we have reserves.
Right. And so I'm just wondering about on the revenue issue as well, that is it politically then, given the sort of the relatively short overview that a lot of politicians have of their place within the state's, you know, the life of the state's economy, there is there a lot of incentive then to obviously focus on short-term revenue that looks good on paper, that you can talk about and that you can then put out as spending programs, rather than dealing with much more, I guess, for want of a better word, sort of unsexy sort of propositions like addressing historical debt and unfunded pensions, that kind of thing?
Yeah, politicians, you know, they know what gets them votes. But, you know, I think that the public needs to go back to them and say, no, you know, we are also very concerned about our fiscal condition of our government and need to focus on that.
Sheila, I couldn't help but notice on Mark's question on what we should do, I wouldn't call it a dodge, but you didn't give it a direct answer. I think I interpreted your answer to say, at least we need to start by getting people to ask the right questions and to see the full picture. Then we'll come up with sort of a game plan, that there's not an easy way out of a hole of debt, et cetera. But the way we start that conversation is with an honest look at the numbers. Is that fair?
Right, and what we recommend that states do is, and this can also be found on our website, is we propose fact-based budgeting, which you use, you know, the facts when you budget, and you include all of your costs, and you only include revenue that you earn in that period. And so, you know, that's a good first start. You know, you need to know exactly where you're at. Before you can figure out how to dig yourself out of it.
But you are not, your organization doesn't espouse individual policy measures as a way of dealing with this. This is more about spreading the accurate information and arming citizens with better knowledge?
Right. The only policy that we push is truthful and transparent accounting and budgeting.
Right. And this is, I think you also talk about this as GAAP, which are generally accepted accounting principles. So I assume these the kind of methodology that you're talking about is in operation at the control level of the controller's office, but that doesn't translate into the political process, certainly at the party level and at the administrative level. So is there some way that you think a broader effort, that it would be worth people engaging in a broader effort to sort of close gaps between the principles and practice that are going on at one level of government but not transferring over to the administrative arm?
Well, I think, you know, one thing just to back up, you know, again, the current generally accepted accounting principles that the comptroller uses are flawed because they don't include the unfunded pension liability and retiree health care liability. But as far as the budget process, you know, the comptroller is the chief financial officer of the state, and it would be very good if they were, you know, part of the largest financial decision that the state makes, which is the budget process. So we recommend that the comptroller work with the budget people and produce, you know, estimated financial statements. If this budget passes, you know, what would the income statement of the state look? And put that on the top of the budget, you know, so people could read that instead of the 518 pages, so they could get a very clear picture of what's the consequence that this budget is going to have.
Can I also jump in and ask you, Sheila, I'm reading a headline in The New Yorker today, and I wonder if this kind of stuff drives you crazy or if you think there's a place for it in extreme times. Because we've been talking about the truthful numbers, the numbers that your organization says would be a much more accurate depiction of where budgets are and where a state or a government's financial house is. Well, and then there's the question of what to do about it. Well, we know there have been other parts of the world in crisis, and here's The New Yorker headline today. All you ever or never wanted to know about quantitative easing. And they write, in a last gasp effort to prevent an already depressed European economy from tumbling into a deflationary spiral, the European Central Bank today announced a 1.1 trillion euro program of quantitative easing. What does that mean exactly? Well, it's essentially Christmas for the financial markets, with the central bank, in this case the ECB, playing the role of Santa Claus. Is it legal to print money like that? Sure it is. Does that kind of stuff drive you nuts, or is this a case where, as long as those European governments are presenting an accurate financial picture, you're open to any solutions that governments and citizens derive?
Yeah, Yes, the latter is correct. And, you know, as long as the governments are, you know, the citizens know exactly where we're at, know the financial consequences of such actions are going to be, you know, if they, the citizens then decide that, okay, that's something that we're willing to do. Truth in accounting is, you know, we're not fine with it, but it's outside of our mission.
We've been talking to the folks from Truth in Accounting. Sheila Weinberg is the founder and CEO of Truth in Accounting that you can find at truthinaccounting.org. And Matthew Leonard, some final thoughts
here? Or statedatalab.org as well. Sheila, so in terms of people's kind of sense of making of navigating the budget, the budget thing, the most robust kind of approach they can take is to go back to May 2014 when the last audited statements for the state were put out. Is there a kind of a need for more, I guess, real active information happening kind of more in real time? Is this kind of time lag now we're in a new budget period in January and yet the figures that we're looking at are going back to the middle of last year, basically?
Yeah, part of, you know, transparency is timeliness. And so obviously the more timely the information, the more useful the information is.
I also have a question. Mark follows up and says, what's the problem with carrying debt forward this way? It apparently hasn't been hurting state governments to operate this way, even if what they say is inaccurate has been presented to the public. So he's saying, what's the harm if this doesn't change?
The harm is, again, that you just cannot hold your elected official accountable. If the government, you know, if your elected officials were including these expenses in the prior budgets, they would have had to raise taxes to cover those. And then people would have gone, well, hold it, I don't like taxes, so maybe I won't vote for these people. But because they've been able to hide these, you know, growing costs, you know, the taxpayers have not been able to make that decision.
And let me start to wrap our conversation, Sheila, with that national question. We've been talking about state governments, New York state government, and of course the New York state budget was released this week. It's a timely conversation, but right there on the front, as I said, of the website for Truth in Accounting is the U.S. published national debt, $18 trillion and counting, and the truth, $83 trillion. And counting. And again, for those who are going to be confused about where that number is derived, $83 trillion comes from what?
$83 trillion comes from how much we have promised our seniors, our veterans, our federal employees, our Social Security recipients, and Medicaid care recipients. Those promises are not in the $18 trillion.
Why isn't that baked into the current cake, especially with all of the very, very wise people? I guess what I'm saying, Sheila, is if they're not baking that into the actual numbers of the cake that we're being presented, wouldn't it behoove one party or another to point this out? I mean, they would have to all be in this cabal of deceit, you know, Democrats, Republicans, independents, and the like, that wouldn't want those numbers published.
Well, what you have is you know, the... You know, if the Democrats, you know, you assume that they want to, you know, increase cost and provide more services and benefits, well, if the real numbers are produced and people realize we're far in debt, you know, they might not get that. And then the Republicans, if you assume that they want tax cuts, well, how would you do a tax cut if we're so far in debt?
A fair question. Sheila, thanks for taking the time. And again, a timely conversation the week the New York State budget comes out. The website, one more time for our listeners,
is truthinaccounting.org, statedatalab.org, and our Twitter handle is @truthin.
Very good. Thanks for taking the time, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
Sheila Weinberg is the founder and CEO of Truth in Accounting. 60-second break, and we continue right here on Innovation Friday. Stay with us. Welcome back to Connections and Innovation Friday. I'm Evan Dawson, and joined in studio now by our colleague Michelle Faust.
Hi.
Always nice to see you. How are you?
It's very nice to see you as well. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
You haven't been doing anything lately, right? Michelle had a few days off, and she comes back and is busier than I have. I think I've ever seen you here, and that's quite saying something in the last year that you've been here. Michelle, you've been working on many things, including a poverty forum coming up. We call it a poverty forum, but that's sort of a shorthand. What's coming up?
Well, we're
going
to have a screening of the program called A Path Appears. There's a series of documentaries that we'll have on WXXI television that'll be airing through February. The episode that we'll be showing is episode 2, and that'll be airing February 2nd at 10 p.m. But we'd really like it if the public came out and watched it with us at the Little on Monday. That'll start at 7 o'clock, and it'll be followed by a forum that I'll be moderating. We'll be talking about... The program, I just watched it again last night to get prepared, the program talks about some of the results and some approaches to getting people out of poverty. And there's three pieces to it. It starts in Virginia and looking at some early childhood intervention and some programs where people are coming into the home and helping young mothers that are living in poverty. Then the second scene deals with people living in poverty in Haiti. And then the following scene is, and the final scene is young pregnancy, teen pregnancy in Colombia. But all of those things are things that we see in our region, and we'll be talking about that, and we'll have a little forum and a discussion as some of the problems that we have in the community and some of the ways that we are looking to solve those problems.
Monday, 7 p.m. at the Little Theater, and I think next hour we're going to bring Michelle back. We're going to talk a little bit more about this and among the various other things that Michelle is covering. So thank you. See you in about an hour.
Okay, see you.
Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail, and our colleague back in studio. And what's next on the
So we're going to kind of stay with a different angle on the budget. Evan, and we're joined now by Tom Stewart. Tom's the executive director of the National Center for the Middle Market, based in Columbus, Ohio, which is a collaboration with the Ohio State University Fisher School of Business. Tom, thanks very much for being with us on Innovation Friday today.
Delighted to be with you.
Great to have you on board. And first of all, let's talk a little bit about the significance and the position the middle markets, what you're talking about as the middle markets within the U.S. economy. What sort of space do they occupy in that broad picture of the U.S. economy?
So we define the middle market as being that segment of businesses that are the middle third, bigger than small, smaller than big. So what's in the middle? Those are businesses with revenue between $10 million and $1 billion, which is a big spread. But as I said, it's the middle third. About a third of private sector employment is in smaller companies and GDP. About a third is in larger companies. And it's the middle third, and it tends to be the forgotten heroes or the forgotten champions of American business. There are about 200,000 companies there. In New York, they employ about 31% of the workforce. Nationally, it's about a third. That sort of varies a little bit by state. If the U.S. middle market were an economy on its own, it would be the fifth largest in the world, bigger than all of Germany. And it is where... It is the segment of the economy that has been growing the fastest, both in terms of revenue growth and employment growth. It's where the growth is. It's where the jobs are. Jobs are being created. And it's where the revenue growth is. So it's actually the most dynamic sector of the economy.
And in terms of why you say it is forgotten, I assume what you're saying is forgotten when it comes to, I don't know, policy discussions, comments about taxes, et cetera. We often hear that small business is the engine of the economy, and we often also hear that the biggest companies get the biggest breaks. Is that why you're saying middle market is forgotten?
Yeah, that's part of it. It's not just in the policy environment. It's in other areas as well. First of all, 85% of these companies are private. So there's no stock market stories or very few stock market stories. There's a lot less data because a lot of private companies keep it private. And so a lot of economists, chief economists, investment banking firms and so on and so forth, basically cannot report what's going on in the middle market. So there's this sort of a vacuum there. The other thing, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have And we should have a romance of the small business, you know, Wozniak and Jobs in a garage and so on and so forth. And that's absolutely true. It's one of the glories of the U.S. economy is that small business startup entrepreneurial engine. But small business creates a lot of jobs and it also destroys a lot of jobs. You know, I mean, 6 out of 10 startups don't last 6 years. And so there's a lot of churn there. And it's when you get to that mid-size that you get companies, the middle market, these companies, the median age is 31. So they've been around for a while. And I like to think of them as the guy with the factory at the end of the road who's now employing the daughter or son of the guy he hired a generation before. And the mayor barely knows his name. The Chamber of Commerce doesn't pay much attention to them. The business development groups don't pay much attention to them. And Congress doesn't pay much attention. You know, they just sort of go on and do, they're like the middle child. They go on and do their work and get less attention. It has policy implications. I sort of think, you know, if you think about taxes, and regulations. In many cases, small business is exempt from certain regulations or certain taxes. Big business, well, they've got a whole fleet of K Street lawyers that find their way working through the complexities of the tax code, and they're multinational, so they can play location games, you know, sort of hide the profit games. But the mid-sized company is in one or two locations. He's sort of like a guy with a W-2 who doesn't itemize his deductions.
Right. I was going to say, because a lot of the discussion, a lot of the ways in which incentives are being put in place is through things like tax breaks, you know, not cash injections necessarily, but tax breaks and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. What does that mean for these range of companies that you're representing and talking about?
Well, two things. First of all, let's remember that despite these difficulties, they're doing amazingly well. Last year, the year-on-year revenue growth, the mean revenue growth for the middle market, was 7.2%, and that's, I think the S&P 500 was 4.9%. And the job growth was 5%, and it was about 2.2 for both small business and large business. So first of all, they're doing really well. But these inhibitions show up in policy in a number of ways. Last week, I was in Buffalo at a meeting put together by the Upstate Venture Association of New York and heard some stories about, for example, how in New York State you can get a lot of government support if you're a company in South Carolina and want to move to New York. Mm-hmm. But heaven forfend if you're trying to expand your factory and hire 50 new people, and you go through a bunch of regulatory hurdles and almost disincentives to doing it, whereas the guy who might be bringing 50 jobs from South Carolina gets the tax breaks and gets the incentives. So there's a lot of ways in which policy and the implementation of policy puts unnecessary barriers in front of the guys who are already here and already doing pretty good work.
Right. But this also gets into another interesting conversation that we followed pretty closely here, and you're sort of hinting at the role of some of these industrial development agencies where, let's say you're a car dealership or you're perhaps a company in the range that you're talking about, and there's been a lot of discussion about the effectiveness, particularly in terms of job creation, for some of the money that's been put out there to support existing businesses to, say, expand their workforce or whatever, but hasn't been any real accountability at the back end of that for the number of jobs that were actually created for that investment. And there seemed to be a little bit of maybe a disconnect there between some of those businesses they wouldn't leave the area. You know, it's not like they're going to leave the area because they don't have those incentives, but then maybe some of them haven't also been producing the job growth that's been promised when they've received some of those economic development subsidies.
There's a certain dance with the guy who brought you, sort of opportunity, and I think that's absolutely right. We have recently completed some research in association with the Brookings Institution, mm-hmm, about accelerating exports from middle market companies. Brookings has done a lot of work with metro cities and trying to get, you know, help metropolitan areas develop economic plans, and a lot of them think, gee, can we increase our exports? And if you double click on that,
yep,
you find that the companies that could export but aren't tend to be mid-sized companies. The small guys usually can't. They don't have. They're not. They're just not big enough to have the capability. The big guys already are, but the gap between potential and accomplishment tends to be in the middle. And then if you talk to the business development offices in these cities or metropolitan areas, whatever, and you sort of say, how do you spend your time? You find that they spend the most amount of time trying to lure a big plant, you know, trying to get GM to put a new plant here in town or Procter & Gamble or whatever. So they try to lure a Fortune 500 company or somebody from abroad. Mm-hmm. That's the number one use of time. Number two use of time is with incubators, startups, and small business. And number three is with the guys in the middle.
Yeah.
And then if you look at job creation, it's in the reverse order. You know, that big P&G plant may happen, but it's a black swan. It's, you know, it's a Hail Mary pass. The small business incubators, some of them work, some of them don't. But the guys in the middle are already growing, already there, and you can really move the needle on job creation by focusing there.
Then why don't we simplify, essentially, policy approach to regulation, taxes, tax incentives, those kind of why not essentially make it uniform, which would probably satisfy a lot of people who are frustrated with the notion that there is any sort of favor, whether it's last year when New York State was talking about an upstate manufacturer's franchise tax to zero and the non-manufacturer said, what about us? Or you know, why not just simplify things?
Well, you know, you make a very good point. And before I answer it, let me remind you that I'm in a .org as part of a .edu, and I'm not going to make policy recommendations. But
but go ahead anyway.
one of the things that we that you know in our work at the National Center for the Middle Market, we see this all the time, and complexity is there to because it benefits somebody. So, you know the line in Machiavelli that the hardest thing in the world to do is to change the order of things, change the nature of things, because there is always somebody who is benefiting from the current system, and the benefits of the future system are notional. They're hypothetical. Somebody's going to win, but there's, you know, but those are birds in the bush, and somebody's got a bird in the hand. And so all of these things do serve purposes, and they serve constituencies that want to hold on to it. And they will struggle mightily to hold on to it. You know, you think of agricultural subsidies and you know crop subsidies and all these subsidies for fossil fuels, subsidies for solar. You know, you can think of all these things. People want to hold on to them because the complexity serves them well, and the constituency for the future is a little more hypothetical.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder. That's got me thinking, though, about say the role of some of the legacy big businesses that perhaps have more political leverage or certainly have certainly more heavily represented or have more interest at the political level to perhaps influence some of those conversations you were just talking about, Tom, and that we are seeing a changing picture. I just wanted to ask you, while we've got time, just to talk specifically about a little bit more about the middle market in New York State. And people can go to the middlemarketcenter.org, and there is an infographic for New York State that reflects the data that you've pulled together about the middle market in New York State for the fourth quarter of 2014, Tom. And you referred to a couple of the national indicators, revenue and employment growth. So how did New York State kind of stack up against those national indicators?
First, quickly, the portrait. You're talking about 10,000 companies.
Yep.
You're talking about more than about half a trillion dollars in annual revenue. You're talking about 31% of the workforce in New York, and it's all over. So it's in construction, healthcare, retail, wholesale, manufacturing, business services, financial services. The middle market as a whole over-indexes on manufacturing, and so does New York. Like 14% of the U.S. of the New York middle market is manufacturing. How it's doing is actually pretty well. I mentioned that the last 12 months nationally, growth has been 7.2% in the middle market. New York State, 7.4%, so you know, 2/10 of a point higher. The employment growth, it's been 5% nationally, 5.4% in New York State. Some of the reason that the New York job growth has been higher than the national average has something to do with industry mix. We got a lot of business services in New York, you know, advertising, architectural firms, consulting firms, and so on and so forth, accounting firms, many of them mid-size. And you don't get a lot of labor productivity in those businesses. You know, with a factory, a manufacturer, you can put in a new plant and you can get more output per worker. Not so much true with an accounting firm or an ad agency. Revenue and employment go pretty closely in sync. But basically, top line and employment growth going slightly ahead of the national average. Confidence, a little less confident than the national average. The middle market is really bullish on its local economy. 81% say our local economy is doing just fine. Only 74% in New York. In the national economy, it's a little bit of a difference. It's 71, 73. It's pretty close. The other thing that's really interesting is there's a big appetite for investment. These guys are mostly conservatively managed companies. I said they're private. They're spending their own money. They need to keep deep cash reserves like a camel going, you know, in case there's a desert. They need to carry their money with them because they need those reserves. But we ask them, if you had an extra buck, would you put it under the mattress or would you put it to work? And that number has been kicking along at about 63-62% say we'd invest it, and the rest say they'd save it. Well, it popped nationally to 68% say they'll invest it. In New York, 69% say they're invested. So this is a group that's been doing well and is now opening its wallets significantly to more investment. Expects to be doing even better. And given the title of this show, one other little fact, this is not a New York fact, but a national fact, the number that say they intend to introduce a new service or product this year is the highest we've ever seen. It's half of them say they'll do a new service or new product this year. So that investment is showing up in innovation, capital spending, new plant and equipment, and it's showing up in human capital and hiring.
All right, Tom Stewart on the line with us. He's the executive director of the National Center for the Middle Market. A couple of quick listener interjections here. We're going to get to the phones in just a second, and a question from a listener, Tom, real briefly. Small businesses, middle markets, large companies, is there much of a difference in the types of businesses in those classes, or are they pretty homogenous?
I think they're pretty consistently diverse. I wouldn't say they're homogenous, right? But the diversity is pretty consistent. The middle market tends to be, as I said, overweighted in manufacturing. A classic, you know, as I said, the guy with the factory down at the end of the road. Middle market is more manufacturing oriented than the economy as a whole. A little less financial services than the economy as a whole, but there's a lot of diversity in both.
All right, and real briefly, Andrew, I know we've been talking about a lot of things in these last 48 hours, and Andrew wants to weigh in from around a quick. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, hi, Tom. That's great news that you're reporting.
Thank you.
The problem that we're having, and yesterday's show really ties into today's show, and what yesterday's show was all about Sheldon Silver, is that we have a spending problem in New York, and Sheldon Silver and his people, and unfortunately Joe Morelli is one of them, they spend like crazy, and we're going into debt, and we've got good business and good business principles, but we're just going to go broke with all of this extra spending that we can't keep up with.
Well, Andrew, thanks for the call, and again, that's sort of tangential to part of Tom Stewart's point, but Tom, real briefly, I think what he's saying is can't always rely on government, to, especially if we look at the real numbers and the debt's worse than we think. Any quick thoughts on that?
I think, you know, the quick thought simply is that you need the right ratio of debt to GDP and government spending to GDP. And yeah, if government spending gets out of control, that is a problem. On the other hand, we also know that middle market companies in New York and everywhere else are saying we also have an infrastructure problem. And so there's a difference between government spending and what you might call government investment. And we're seeing some pretty clear indications from the companies we talk to that they really would like to see more investment in infrastructure, and they're willing to pay for it.
And 30 seconds, Tom, just also the cost of healthcare. This must be something that's kind of factoring in the middle market companies' thinking.
When we ask for them for their top 5 challenges or top 20 challenges, healthcare has always been at the top of the list. It's going down a little bit, I think, for two reasons. Number one, people know how the Affordable Care Act is going to work, is working, so it's not as uncertain. And also, as we've seen, the rate of healthcare cost growth has slowed down a little bit. But it's still an intense issue.
Tom, where can people find more information about middle markets?
Middlemarketcenter.org.
Thanks for taking the time to join us on Innovation Friday.
Thank you very much.
It's Tom Stewart.
Yeah, Executive Director of the National Center for the Middle Market based in Columbus, Ohio, the State University there with the Fisher College of Business. Some really good, some really good raw data and trends there to look at. Middlemarketcenter.org, as Tom said.
These 2 hours are flying, as they always do on Innovation Friday. Evan Dawson and Matthew Leonard and you, as we take a short break and come right back right here on member-supported public radio.